You've downloaded the episode, pulled it up on your iPod pad phone thingy, and you've even pushed play.
Oh man, what did I do? Oh, jeez, is this broken?
There's no going back.
Aww.
Written in his bathroom, Geek Talk Entertainment Thingies Inconceivable. Produced in his basement, Hysterically Accurate News of the World, Wall Steve Journal, and more. Now on the web, everywhere. iTunes, Facebook, Stitcher, SoundCloud, Podomatic. It's time for the Voice of Steve podcast. And now, if the medication is doing what it's supposed to, here's the host of the Voice of Steve podcast.
Insert funny name here.
It's the fourth day of the seventh month of the sixth year of the second decade of the 21st century. Hi, it's me, Steve, and this is the 252nd episode of the Voice of Steve podcast. Hi, how are you? Habilimented! And a happy 4th of July as well, except for the people at Sony, who have now successfully ruined Independence Day for everybody. It's odd that the one time Will Smith decides not to be in a movie, it's one of the smartest decisions he ever makes.
Men in Black 3.
So, yeah, it's the 4th of July. You know, I'd usually save something like this for Hysterically Accurate, but did you know they were originally going to do the signee of the declaration thingy on the 5th of July? Yeah, they were going to do it on the 5th of July. Yeah, they wanted to be able to high-five each other on the 5th of July, you see? It's kind of weird, but probably a Mason thing, so, you know, we won't argue with that. But oddly enough, one of the guys who was going to be at the thing for the thing accidentally blew off one of his fingers messing around with a box of Zeus fluorescent artillery shells. So not only was the high-five thing ruined, but they sort of thought it would be bad form if one of the gang bled to death. So they quick signed the declaration on the 4th of July and got Mr. Clumsy Four Fingers to the hospital. Hey, a lesson learned here, folks. Be careful with them fireworks so you don't ruin your celebration of Independence Day. Or any other day, for that matter. Yeah, don't be that guy. I want you coming back to work on Tuesday with all the fingers you left with last Friday. Got it? Hey, have fun, but be safe. Oh, hey, I've got a ton of stuff for you this week on the Voice of Steve podcast. So much, I'm not even sure what all's gonna make it past dress rehearsal. So let's just get right to it and see what happens, shall we? Let's. We'll get right to whatever the heck is gonna kick things off. Probably what the crap, right after this thing, next on the Voice of Steve podcast. Yeah, or whatever.
The Civil War, the deadliest war in the history of the United States.
I eat Confederate soldiers for breakfast, and right now, I'm very hungry.
A nation torn asunder, North versus South. Brother versus brother.
A house divided against itself cannot stand, so let's blow this mother down.
Now, experience the Civil War as it was always meant to be experienced.
Is there anything you'd like to tell me before we start?
Yeah, General Lee, I'm gonna kill you pretty soon.
I see. How exactly?
First, I'm going to use you as a human shield. Then I'm going to kill this guard over here with the Patton 1853 Enfield on the table. And then I was thinking about breaking your neck.
Budco Entertainment, along with Pump 'Em Out Pictures, presents...
War means fighting, and fighting means killing. The business of a soldier is to fight, to move swiftly and strike vigorously and secure all the fruits of victory and all of those things. That is the secret of successful war.
Arnold Schwarzenegger as Abraham Lincoln.
This nation under God shall have a new birth of freedom, and that government of the people, by the people, for the people, and all of those things shall not perish from the earth. But you, on the other hand, are toast.
The role he was born to play. Because not a lot of people know this, but Abraham Lincoln was like three quarters Austrian.
I rise only to say that I do not intend to say anything. I thank you for your hearty welcomes and good cheers.
In a Mick G, Shane Black, co-directed, double-jointed kind of joint thing.
Come on, do it, come on, kill me, I'm here, kill me, I'm here, kill me, come on, kill me, I'm here, come on, do it now, kill me.
Civil War, Musket of Justice.
Let off some steam, Jefferson Davis.
A story of a man, his country, and the truth. Finally revealed about how Abraham Lincoln was at Gettysburg not just to give some fancy speech, but to waste the Confederate Army with a wicked, awesome machine gun.
You are a funny man, General Lee. I like you. That's why I'm going to kill you last.
Without doubling, marching by the flank to theaters next summer, Civil War. Musket of Justice.
In the universe, there is only one absolute. Everything freezes. Get to the chopper.
It is time now for another edition of...
What the crap?
You simply have to be careful if you're going to do anything in the wild. You never know what you're going to run into. A sharp-toothed predator? A dangerous plant that could get you sick? Charlie Sheen desperate for someone to pay attention to him? Yeah, it's dangerous out there. Case in point, Joanne Barnaby was in the remote Canadian wilderness picking mushrooms. Not sure why we have to point out that the Canadian wilderness Miss Barnaby was in was remote. Doesn't seem like there's much about Canada that isn't remote. Anywho, Joanne's in the Canadian wilderness picking mushrooms. She turns around and finds her doggie, Joey, in a growling match with a starving wolf. This wolf had been stalking Miss Barnaby and Joey, trying to separate them and drive them deeper into the woods. Joanne Barnaby was getting worried as night was falling. The mosquitoes were getting thick, she and her pooch were getting tired, and that black wolf wasn't getting any less hungry. Then Joanne heard the sound of a mother bear and its cub talking back and forth, trying to find each other. She followed the sound of the cub, hoping to lure the wolf into a trap. Of course, the bear could just as easily pounce on Joanne and Joey, and that would not be good. Fortunately, Mama Bear thought the wolf was a bigger threat to her cub, so she clobbered it instead. Then, just like they show you in those Disney movies, Joanne, Joey, Mama Bear, and the cub broke into song as they headed back to the highway and Joanne's car. She offered to take the bear family out for a snack at the local Waffle House, but Mama Bear knew she had to get Baby Bear back home before their porridge got less just right.
Well, there you have it, folks. Another happy ending from the good people at Jimmy James Incorporated.
I don't know about you, but I want to live in a city that is safe from crime. I don't want to have to worry about getting mugged or beat up or murderficated whilst I'm out and about having a good time. I would assume you're in the same boat. You're looking for a place where you know you'll be safe. Well, look no further. Your search is over. You need to pack all your stuff and head west to beautiful Oakland, California. I mean, you may not want to bring anything of any value, because, well, you know, it's Oakland, California. But hey, get yourself to Oakland, California, the city that isn't Chicago. Okay, full disclosure, Oakland is a pretty rough town. There have been times where the murder rate in Oakland has been twice that of New York City. Unfortunately, the police in Oakland, the folks that, you know, would seem to be the ones to actually do something about all the criminals, you know, criming all over the place, well, they're not doing much better. They're criming almost as much as the criminalers are. Things are so bad that Sean Wendt, the chief of police, resigned about 10 days ago. Oh, but that's okay. We got a new guy when the mayor appointed Ben Farrow to lead the police force. I'm sorry, what? What's that? Oh, mayor canned him too? Oh, well, no, that's not a big deal. Yeah, they just want to get the right person in there. Oh, and look, there he is. There's Paul Figueroa. He'll be a great acting police chief, because, you know, I'm sure he'll act all police chiefy and take a big old bite out of...
Wah, 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 wah.
I'm sorry, what?
Wah, 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 wah.
Now he's gone too?
Wah, 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 wah.
What was he in there, like 2 days? Yikes. Okay, well, maybe we gotta think this through before you, you know, head Oakland way. I mean, living in the middle of a gang fight at a maximum security Mexican prison would probably be safer at this point. But don't worry, we'll figure something out.
Oh, yes! I hate this! It is revolting!
The voice of Steve's criminal record. Well, it'll be other people's crimes. Steve doesn't actually have a criminal record, so we won't be talking about him. It'll be about other people who have committed crimes, but not Steve, because as I mentioned earlier, Steve doesn't have...
Oh, for the love of... Just get on with it before I get a criminal record for beating somebody with a crowbar.
Voice of Steve's criminal record.
Corruption sucks. People with the guttitudinal cojonitation to do things that help themselves while hurting others. How's about this for a super example? According to Fox News, 7 former state workers in Delaware were indicted after authorities uncovered a massive food stamp fraud scheme. These 7 ladies were working for the Department of Health and Social Services, and they were the ones who were supposed to be issuing the snazzy debit card thingies people would use to buy food. Apparently, it was pretty easy for these fine, upstanding examples of citizenry to set up fake electronic benefit transfer accounts, thereby setting up fake cards they could put money on. Yeah. These cards were sent to state service centers where some of the other fraudsters worked. They'd grab them and either go stock up on Cheetos Puffs and Nutella or sell them at a discount to other really nice people. Altogether, these bastages stole more than $959,000 in fraudulent benefits. More than $959,000. So, maybe $959,001, because it was more than 959. Some of these folks are only getting probation, but I'm hoping the masterminds get some serious time in the clink. Maybe more than 959,000 years.
And that's how she wrote.
We all lose stuff, right? Your car keys, your wallet, your prison inmate who escaped back in 1979 while serving a 16-year sentence for manslaughter. Man, I hate it when that happens. Well, I can certainly relate to the folks at the Georgia Department of Corrections, because that's just what happened to them 37 years ago. Billy Birchfield, who's not just a cliched Southern name, busted his way out of the Who's Cow back in 1979 and was never recaptured. Well, until now, that is. Police in Laurel County, Kentucky, say they found young Mr. Birchfield living under an assumed name, Harold Arnold. And if that name didn't actually come from a deceased cousin, I'd say one of the new charges Birchfield should be defending himself from would be worst assumed name ever. I mean, seriously, Harold Arnold? Doesn't he realize you need a first name and a last name? The other bit of poor decision-making was Birchfield's choice of a hidey hole, Laurel County, Kentucky. Look, when you escape from a prison in Georgia, the last thing you want to do is run to Kentucky. I mean, you're only a couple of miles away from Florida or Texas. Texas is right over there. Hop on a bus and you're chilling in Houston or Dallas or whatever. The detectives that pulled the short straw found Birchfield in a house in Laurel County, and he submitted to fingerprinting. FBI officials used the prints to confirm his identity. Of course, Birchfield denied being Birchfield, but that's not so odd. I would too if I were him. The sad thing here is that Birchfield was keeping a pretty low profile these last 37 years and had no criminal record in Kentucky. Though, that's not too difficult. You gotta do some pretty cuckoo stuff to break the law in Kentucky, right?
What on earth was I drinking last night? My head feels like there's a Frenchman living in it.
And now, covering sports ESPN is afraid to touch, and NBC Sports Network can't afford the rights to. It's time for Voice of Steve Sports. Camel wrestling, cheese rolling, bog snorkeling, chess boxing, extreme ironing. Now, let's go to the Voice of Steve Sports desk and your Voice of Steve Sports anchor, the Voice of Steve.
Usually, those fine folks over at the UFC are so soft-spoken and polite to one another, it's sort of hard to build any drama before any of these fights. Like when Brad One Punch Pickett held the door for the natural-born killer Carlos Condit. Whoop-de-freaking-do. Well, thankfully, there's at least one guy out there, Michael the Count Bisping, who knows how to crank things up to 11 before you plunk down your 75 smackers for the pay-per-view fight. Bisping went up against Dan, all the good nicknames were already taken, Henderson, at UFC 100 back in 2009, and things didn't go well for Bisping. In fact, Henderson took Bisping out in what is called one of the most epic one-punch takedowns since Batman vs. Guy Gardner back in 1987. Now, Bisping has agreed to enter the ring again this coming October, and the fur is flying well before the fists.
He obviously has a great knockout victory over me back in the day, and he's gonna retire soon. So I want to get revenge for that loss before he retires. He was on testosterone replacement therapy in that fight. I didn't even know that existed. Dan, you're a cheat. Let's do it any time you want, you old... He knocked out the posing dwarf, Hector Lombard. So if you want to come and try it, hey, buddy, lightning doesn't strike twice. So if you're interested, sign on the dotted line, you piece of shit.
Ah, that's great. Certainly more fun than when Amir Khan Predator Adave pulled out the chair for Michelle the Karate Hottie Watterson.
Now I concede I bring out the worst in you. Let me just help you to not say something you're just going to torture yourself about for years to come.
It won't fit in sports. It's not a thingy of entertainment or something geeks talk about. It's not even inconceivable. This is the segment for stories that don't fit anywhere else.
I don't know about you, but I'm getting kind of bored with all of the books and the movies and the TV shows and all of those things about the robots rising up and taking over the world and enslaving all of the humans and all of those things. I mean, it's not like I don't like the idea. I think it'll be super awesome when our benevolent mechanical overlords are herding us into confinement camps to turn our biomaterial into fuel for their civilization. I'm just wondering when we're gonna get to it and make it real already. Well, thanks to Berkeley-based roboticist Alexander Reben, that reality is a step or two closer. You see, Reben has invented a robot where, if you put your finger under its single arm, it might just jab you. Or, maybe, the robot will leave you alone. You just never know. Reben has built the robot, the human Jabotronic 6000, to inflict the minimal amount of pain, and it doesn't give you much of a wound, but it is still technically harmful. So we have a robot that will now ignore Isimov's three laws of robotics. One, a robot may not injure a human being or, through inaction, allow a human being to come to harm. Number two, a robot must obey orders given it by human beings except where such orders would conflict with the first law. And three, a robot must protect its own existence as long as such protection does not conflict with the first or second law. Well, let's just go ahead and add that fourth law, shall we? A robot will not harm a human unless a human keeps putting its finger, or any other body part, like its head, under the robot. Then the robot is allowed to jab the human with a small needle or a Sumerian battle axe, especially if the robot is having a particularly bad day.
You're a feisty little one, but you'll soon learn some respect.
Voice of Steve. News of the World.
According to those shows hosted by Mike Rowe, there are a lot of really hard, dirty, difficult, yucky jobs out there. Well, the one that just shot to the top of the list is guard for the drug lord Joaquin El Chapo Guzman. Mexico's Secretariat of National Defense announced that the body of 20-year-old Jorge Mauricio Melendez Herrera, part of the team that guarded the outside of the prison where El Chapo is currently being held, was found on Friday. A forensic scientist, who has lots of practice determining the cause of death in drug cartel-related murder cases, determined Melendez Herrera was killed from a blow to the back of the neck. He was also stabbed multiple times after he was shot and thrown down three flights of stairs. and run over with a 1976 Ford Cortina Mark IV. It is also believed that Melendez Herrera was tortured by being forced to watch the 1972 film An American Hippie in Israel twice. Fearing something was up, the Mexican government deployed 300 additional soldiers to increase security at the prison, though the only way to get those soldiers to agree to the duty was to lie to them and tell them they were actually going to pick strawberries at Grandma's farm.
Listen, hotshot, I'm going to tell you something right now. I don't care for you or for the putrid sludge you're troweling out.
C-sections aren't typically the way a mother wants to give birth to her child. Apparently, there's nothing quite like actually giving birth the old natural, super-duper painful way. Everything I've heard about it makes it seem rather pleasant. More relaxing. Like sitting on your front porch on a warm spring day, drinking ice-cold lemonade, while someone is pushing a watermelon out of your hoo-ha. Ah, that sounds nice. But sometimes, due to medical necessity, a baby has to be brought into the world through a cesarean section, or C-section, a surgical operation for delivering a child by cutting through the wall of the mother's abdomen. Well, when you put it like that, that almost seems more fun than the traditional birthing method. Regardless, even if the mother must go through a C-section, the mother should expect that the only thing that is not connected to her body in some way after the procedure is the baby. Unfortunately for Ella Clark, she'd wind up missing something else as well. Miss Clark began hemorrhaging during the procedure, causing her to need an emergency hysterectomy, 5 blood transfusions, and to be put into a medically induced coma. So she was fine, right? The massive blood loss is what I was talking about before, what she lost, right? Not so much. While she was in the coma, Clark developed blood clots in her legs, which stopped the circulation of blood to her legs. Surgeons tried to restore circulation, but it was too late. The doctors had no choice but to amputate both of her legs. Clark claims that while she was in the coma, the doctors were supposed to monitor her every hour, but that they actually let 6 hours go by before they noticed the problem with the circulation to her legs. The doctors claimed that they were binging the last season of Game of Thrones before the season finale came on, so what were they supposed to do? Well, good luck to Miss Clark and her child, and especially to the medical team that treated her. The hospital they work for is going to amputate them from the staff, I assume.
When you were in that coma, did you feel your brain getting damaged?
It is time now, once again, for another edition of...
What the heck is he talking about?
I think I finally figured out why I'm having such a hard time getting a good night's sleep. I used to think it was because I'd spend all night wondering why I couldn't get a good night's sleep. Yeah, turns out that's only one of the many hundreds... No, thousands of questions I'd been asking myself as I was trying to calm my mind and go to sleep. One of those questions, a question I'd been asking myself ever since I'd been putting clean laundry away for my wife and 2 daughters, why are women's shirt buttons on the left? It was driving me nuts. Other than helping a dunderhead like me figure out why the pastel pink shirt with embroidered ponies and rainbows on them does not belong to my son Oliver, there had to be another reason. Turns out there may be several. Sort of. At one time, it was thought the buttons were on the left because most women were getting some kind of help getting dressed, what with all the stuff they had to put on back in the olden days. It made it easier for the person helping them to fasten the buttons. Well, that turns out to be not so true. Perhaps the buttons are on the left to make breastfeeding easier. Well, I can think of a few ways to make that easier, and they don't have anything to do with which side of the shirt the buttons are on. No, there is a new prevailing thought on the subject. According to Jess Edwards, who wrote for Cosmopolitan UK,
in the 1894 book Man and Woman, a study of secondary and tertiary sexual characters, Havelock Ellis writes that the right-to-left buttoning of women's tops was adopted to make a point that women seem inferior to men in strength and in rapidity and precision of movements. As women began to borrow more of what were originally considered clothes for men, trousers and shirts and stuff, the buttons were placed on a different side to signify a difference between the two.
Alrighty then, so it basically boils down to the dudes noticing that women were wearing clothes kinda like theirs and saying,
ain't no way a lady's gonna button they buttons on the same side of they shirts as a dude. No way, no how.
That's really sexist. And I'm embarrassed to be a dude when I read stuff like that. Tell you what, I'll shoot a quick email to Gloria Steinem real quick and see if she can't take care of that. You know, forget breaking through the glass ceiling. We've got to get the buttons on the right side of the shirt for the ladies. You know, unless you guys are cool with the left side thing. I mean, you know, I'm not the boss of you. You can do whatever you want. But just let me know, though, and I'll call all the guys together for a meeting and we'll start switching the sides for those buttons. You know, whatever you want, because we want to be all gentlemanly nowadays, you know. Oh, and say, when you're done vacuuming and cleaning the toilet and taking care of the kids and buttoning your shirt with the buttons on the left side, will you make me a sandwich? I'm busy watching the game and getting ready for my fourth guys' night out this week. Thanks, doll. Remind me and I'll let you ride in the front seat next time I drive you to the grocery store.
What did you say? That's what I thought you said.
Throughout human history, mankind has looked for answers. Who are we? What is the universe? Why is Velveeta shells and cheese so much better than regular macaroni and cheese? Science has been one of the tools used to search for those answers. And Steve is a tool who wouldn't understand science if Mr. Spock bit him in the brain. But I suppose he's going to talk about science stuff anyway, isn't he? Yep. He's gonna do it. So, I guess, here's
Dr. Steve, Scientifical Guy.
So, remember when you got that skin cream, you know, for the sun, for its birthday? I know, it was hard to figure out what to get it that year. What's the appropriate 4.5 billion year old gift, right? Well, I'm guessing you should have gone with the Blu-ray of Weird Al Yankovic's movie UHF, cause we may be in trouble. Normally, the sun is covered in visible dark blemishes, or sunspots. When there's a whole crap ton of those sunspots, and solar flares and whatnot, that's called a solar maximum. Had one of those back in the early 20-aughts. Well, now we're approaching a solar minimum. This is when sunspots and flares are almost non-existent. But why should we care about the sun's complexion, other than how much complaining we have to listen to, you know? Well, according to weather guy Paul Dorian,
when we're deep into a solar minimum, the blank sunspotless period will stretch on for a few days at first, then a few weeks, and finally, it could last for months at a time. This is leading a lot of us to believe that the next mini ice age is on its way.
But don't worry. After the woolly mammoths and saber-toothed tigers have had their fun, the solar maximum will come back, and those intense solar flares and huge sunspots will be a daily occurrence again. We'll have auroras in Florida, radiation storms will knock out satellites, and create a few superheroes, I'm sure. Plus, all them CB radio operators will get all torqued off with all the radio blackouts. It'll be fun again. In the meantime, make sure you have a jacket, your hat, and both of your gloves, because it's going to get cold around here in a couple million years. Unless this weather guy is wrong. This is probably all just an attempt to distract us from the fact that they can't even tell us what the weather's going to be like 5 minutes from now. I won't believe what this Paul Dorian says until I see the sun explode in my face. And even then, it'll only be for a second or two. So there.
Irritating. Ah, yes. One of your Earth emotions.
It is time now for another edition of
More What the Crap! There's just too much of this stuff!
Some knucklehead decided it would be fun to install an enclosed glass slide at the U.S. Bank building in Los Angeles. Normally, that wouldn't be a big deal. Kind of fun, in fact. Except at one point during the planning phase of this thing, somebody who had apparently had a little too much to drink at lunch decided to throw the idea out there of putting the glass slide on the outside of the U.S. Bank building. 1,000 feet up in the air. Don't ask me to explain how, but there were a few nods in the affirmative to that idea, and it made all the way through the process, and now they're actually letting people use the stupid thing. You slide down this glass slide. Did I mention it's glass? Especially the bottom part. Did I mention that? That's sort of important. You slide 45 feet down this glass slide that goes from the 70th to the 69th floor of the U.S. Bank building in downtown L.A. The most ridiculous part of this slide, part of a $50 million renovation of the building that includes an open-air observation deck, is that you have to pay $25 just to get on the observation deck, and then another $8 to risk your clean shorts, to say nothing of your life, to go down this slide. I mean, what's next? Are they going to let you bungee jump off the top of Nakatomi Towers? Didn't work real well for Hans Gruber, did it?
You're very impressed with yourself, aren't you?
I have my moments.
Oh, and I just thought you should know, if you haven't heard this already, this really is a public service kind of thing. Burger King has unleashed upon the world Mac and Cheetos. Yeah, they're taking Cheetos and shoving mac and cheese in them, and then you buy them, and then you eat them. I assume the plan is for you to not vomit them back up shortly thereafter. I guess that's the idea anyway. Don't know how successful they've been with any of that, either the you buying, you eating, or the you not engaging in an involuntary personal protein spill, but only time will tell. And I think we'll have plenty of time. Just looking at these things tells me they're going to stick around longer than cockroaches and will be here when the alien archaeologists are digging for our fossils. Better be careful where they dig, though. They don't want one of these Mac and Cheetos things to break their shovels or touch their skin or anything.
Maybe there is no intelligent life out there after all.
It is time now for Geek Talk, which is Klingon 4. You are one of six people who own all five William Shatner and all five Leonard Nimoy albums.
So in the past week or so, there's been a lot more going on when it comes to CBS Paramount and their lawsuit against the folks that are making their Star Trek Axanar crowdfunded fan film and their stance on fan films altogether. Last week, CBS Paramount released their official guidelines for folks to follow if they want to make Star Trek fan films and not get sued. In a letter to the fans, CBS Paramount first said they love the idea of fans making films to share. It shows their passion for Star Trek and the company loves it. Then they say, with that in mind, we're gonna all over your passion. Here are some highlights of the guidelines. Number one, the fan production must be less than 15 minutes for a single self-contained story, or no more than two segments, episodes, or parts, not to exceed 30 minutes total, with no additional seasons, episodes, parts, sequels, or remakes, which basically puts the kibosh on 99.9% of all the fan films that people are doing now anyway. Number two, the title of the fan production, or any parts, cannot include the name Star Trek. However, the title must contain a subtitle with the phrase, a Star Trek fan production, in plain typeface. The fan production cannot use the term official in either its title or subtitle, or in any marketing, promotions, or social media for the fan production. So basically, Star Trek cannot be in the title of your Star Trek fan film. Fantastic. Number three, the content in the fan production must be original. Well, that actually makes sense. Gonna make a fan film should be an original idea. That's part of what makes it fun for fans. Like they're contributing to the storyline. Number four, basically the fan production uses commercially available Star Trek uniforms, accessories, toys, and props, and these items must be official merchandise and not bootleg items or imitations of such commercially available products. Basically, buy them from us or make your own. Number five, the fan production must be a real fan production. For example, creators, actors, and all other participants must be amateurs. They cannot be compensated for their services and, cannot be currently or previously employed on any Star Trek series, films, production of DVDs, or with any of CBS or Paramount Pictures licensees. That's a bunch of targ poodoo. Number six, the fan production must be non-commercial. Okay, basically you can't make money from the fan film or put it out there on DVD or Blu-ray. Again, that makes sense. Number seven, the fan production must be family-friendly and suitable for public presentation. Videos must not include profanity, nudity, obscenity, pornography, depictions of drugs, alcohol, tobacco, or any harmful or illegal activity. Well, that makes sense. Unless you're making a Pulp Fiction fan film. You know, that would be a little constricting. I wouldn't expect any of that in a Star Trek film, fan or otherwise, anyway. Number 8 basically says you gotta have a disclaimer saying CBS Paramount owns Star Trek, you don't, and you're not making any money off it. Again, that makes sense. Number 9 says creators of fan productions must not seek to register their works or any elements of their works under copyright or trademark law. So, again, you're making a story off of stuff that somebody else owns, so you can't try to own that story. So, yeah. So, ditto, basically. Number 10, fan productions cannot create or imply any association or endorsement by CBS or Paramount Pictures. Double ditto. So basically, half of these rules, the ones about not making money off the fan film, make sense, and have, for the most part, been followed by most fan filmmakers anyway, until Axanar came along and raised 2 million space bucks to make their thing. At least it certainly seems that way. I mean, Axanar's the one specifically who's getting sued, so, yeah. Anyway, the other half of the rules about the length, no fan series, no cast or crew who've worked on Star Trek and participate, that's just CBS Paramount being spiteful about the fact that a grand majority of the quality Star Trek over the last 10 years has come from fans shooting in front of green screens in their garages. You gotta lighten up, CBS and Paramount. Either that, or you better hope Star Trek Beyond makes $1 billion worldwide. Otherwise, the very folks you depend on to keep Star Trek a viable franchise in this franchise-filled world will abandon you faster than a tribble reproduces. Voice of Steve out.
I suggest you avoid emotionalism and simply keep your instruments correct.
I think I got it, but just in case, tell me the whole thing again. I wasn't listening.
Wow, that was an episode, wasn't it? Well, that should do it. Hey, don't forget to visit patreon.com/thevoiceofstevepodcast so you can join Wayne and Jesse and become a Voice of Steve patron. At this point, I'm looking to earn some money from the Voice of Steve. That way I can provide for my family, which has been easier, let me tell you. Plus, I can justify the time it takes for me to do the show if I'm earning something from it. If it makes more sense for you to do it this way, you can also still visit gofundme.com/thevoiceofsteve and just donate to my ongoing effort. Provide for family, justify the Voice of Steve's existence, and also save money to more properly make the go at a true voiceover career. Hey, thanks in advance for any help you can give. I'd love to hear from you, even if money doesn't have anything to do with it. Please send an email my way to thevoiceofsteve@yahoo.com. There's also the Voice of Steve page on Facebook, facebook.com/voiceofsteve. You could also follow me on Twitter, @thevosshow. I'd really like to hear what you think of the show and what you'd like to hear going forward. Well, that'll do it. Thanks again for doing the interweb thing this week, and I hope to have your ear again next time on the Voice of Steve podcast. Bye.